ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Are you loving work at the moment? Or are you feeling a little detached and uninspired? Hello, I'm Lisa Leong, and you're listening to This Working Life, helping to make your work life better. We made this episode about how to build a better work culture at the beginning of this year. My, how time flies, though. The feeling it captures, though, it still resonates. We may be part of a shared existential crisis that's got people thinking, why are we here? But what is it about the culture of work that's leading to that feeling? And what can you do about it? My guest has some ideas. Jennifer Moss is a workplace culture strategist and an award-winning journalist. Her latest book is called Why We're Here, Creating a Work Culture Everyone Wants. Welcome, Jen.
Thanks for having me, Lisa. I'm really looking forward to our chat.
Well, I think you've hit the nail on the head when you write that the way we work now is not sustainable. Why?
Well, we've had an issue with burnout long before the pandemic. Then the pandemic hit and it all exploded. And then we've gone into this state of polycrisis where we've had this cluster of crises that essentially what happens when you have a polycrisis is that every crisis actually makes the other one that much worse. And so we're living in that world where there's unsustainability in just how we're coping with life. And it's trickling into work. And people are exhausted. We saw the highest level of burnout that we've seen, pre-pandemic. It's just continuing to soar. And I really think just a big part of it is that our behavioral mindset has shifted and we're all just needing a moment of recovery. And we haven't had that yet. It's just been business as usual. And so here we are in this kind of existential crisis. I call it, that everyone's going through a midlife crisis right now.
At the same time.
Across every generation at the same exact time.
And you say that, people are feeling this sense of detachment, a loss of effectiveness, and you use the word ennui, which I think is a fabulous word and I get to use my French. What does ennui mean? Or should I say, qu'est-ce que c'est ennui?
C'est très bien. Vous parlez très bien français. I love that word too. It's kind of like how Adam Grant took the word languishing and just really popularized it. I feel like this sense of ennui is what Gallup is describing right now as the great detachment from work. So people maybe don't have the same mobility, so you're not seeing people quit. But what's worse is having people in your organization extremely disengaged, actively disengaged. So they're talking about how much they hate work to everyone else and trying to get them to quit. We're seeing people rage applying at work. We're seeing people, the idea of quiet quitting is really just, people kind of deciding, I don't want to do this thing anymore, so I'm not going to. And that's worse than people resigning. And a lot of that has to do with this sense of ennui, the sense of feeling like there's no purpose or trajectory, or we're feeling hopeless. We don't see a world of work that we are going to exist in the next decade. And then you have all of this impact of polycrisis that is making us feel really heavy. And that's leading again to that sense of kind of, it's almost like you're aimless and we don't know what to do about it.
And before we move on to the solution in just a moment, there is a concept that you write about, and you've written about it in the Harvard Business Review, and it's about prioritizing growth and productivity. You call it toxic productivity. Why is it toxic?
This has been something I've been thinking about for a long time, and I noticed this for myself, and it actually was part of my burnout story. This idea, I was a co-founder of a tech startup, and it's very difficult for women to get funding. And, you're just in this constant slog. And every time that I would say no to something, I would feel like I'm letting people down, especially as a female founder. I felt this responsibility to, demonstrating that to other women that they can do it too. And there was also you know, this element that I learned about burnout, the only way that you can solve for it is to get rest. And yet everything in our world, every part of our psychology, the way we were raised is to look at rest as laziness and productivity as, you know, almost heroism. And so that attitude is so ingrained, we don't even know how to ignore it. And it's why when we take rest or feel like we're taking rest, we feel like it's bad, like we're doing something bad. It's a four-letter word. And so we have created this, and then all of this other stuff with the pandemic, everything else, just this, you know, constant need to reboot after our GDP went down and productivity went down. We have been driving after this, and it's led to this level of toxicity in our need to be productive. And it is just, it, I have to say this, that it's part of an institutional stress, but it's also part of who we are. I know as a mom of three kids, I'm always feeling like I need to make the perfect lunches. I need to, you know, be at every single game, and I still need to write a book, you know, from my bed in a global pandemic. And that's my own, you know, my own evil, you know, brain that's creating that. And so we need to fight back on it, and organizations need to do a better job of not imposing it.
And what have you done that's been helpful with your own measures of productivity and trying to pare it back a bit?
I've given myself grace for times where it just is a compressed workload. I know I'm near a deadline. I'm probably going to have to work harder. But it's recognizing when it's getting to the point where it's, it's a deathbed regret. You know, I've been using this, like this schematic, like, is answering this email right now going to be a deathbed regret if I don't do it? Or is like not eating dinner with my family or spending time with my parents who are aging, you know, they're 82 and missing out on a dinner, but really having to get this other thing done. And it seems so silly because, and maybe a bit morbid, but I think it's really critical for us to put things into perspective. And so it's created more of, it's like a perspective taking tool, and it helps me recognize. And I do listen to my body more, and I listen to myself a bit more. And it also helps me to make decisions about what I say yes to. You know, if I know that this project is something I just want to do, or it's a vanity project, I might not, you know, say yes to it because it might be a deathbed regret.
Well, I think, yes, that's a big question, but also the question why we're here is it sort of feels like it matches it.
I love the big existential questions, Lisa. It's obviously, I just really, you know, like to torture myself with these big problems.
So we've got a big problem. And so we're going to look at some solutions now. And your hypothesis is really that social and behavioral psychology research can actually be used to transform a workforce from one weighed down with ennui to a healthy and high-performing one. So we're going to look at some of these levers. But is it always at the systemic level that this operates, though?
It is when you look at the root causes, so where we have to go back to. But what's so interesting is that the solutions are actually much simpler than we realize. As humans, we feel like the more rigor, the more complicated it is, the more likely it is to result in a better outcome. And when you really look at looking at both sides, so yeah, the problems are, we have to look at the root causes, but again, those simple tactics, those really tiny incremental tweaks are what actually end up in the best results.
Okay, so let's look at one of your levers, hope. What does the research tell us about how hopeful we are and the consequences of that?
Hope is what, you know, I've really leaned on in my life as a person who has had times where I'm feeling less hopeful. I notice it completely drags me down. And, you know, a lot of the research that I investigated into Unlocking Happiness at Work, which was my first book, there was data that found that if you even look at, and this will be interesting for you as a lawyer, but when you looked at students, when they were, when they were predicting whether a student would graduate from law school, a 20-question hope survey was a better predictor if they would actually graduate law school than any other standardized test. And it really is, because it's about goal setting and feeling the agency that you can achieve your goals, feeling like you have the resources to get there, and creating plan Bs and plan Cs so that you know that you can get to your goals. And I think that's what people mistake about hope theory, is that it's a wish. But when I interviewed all of these, you know, these generals, these colonels in the army, they said hope is the only strategy for them when it comes to putting effective teams on the battlefield. And it's because it helps you deal with chaos. It helps you deal with uncertainty. You have a shared mission between your teammates. And so all of these things right now, when we're in a state of hopelessness, we need more than ever in our organizations.
And how then do you create more hope in the workplace?
Once again, here's these super simple tactical easy ways to do it. And, you know, so much of what I write about in the book are just these simple tactics. And one of them is, you know, celebrating the small wins. We are not good at celebrating incremental goals. It's always about the project that got finished and we cracked the bottle of champagne. And then it's, you know, we hit the gong when we make a big sale. And instead of finding that each one of us should create these daily goals that we kick off. I always say too, we say things that are hopeless. Like, I have a million things to do. No one's able to accomplish a million things in the day. But what if we just had a number? Like, I have five things I have to do today. That's my priority. And, you know, anything above that is like a big celebratory moment. And so making daily goals, even making our bed can build hope. Because it's accomplishing something really small in the day that we subconsciously see as a little bit painful or a little bit difficult. And when we accomplish it, it does build up that sense of hopefulness. And we need to remind everyone that every time they do this task or every time they contribute to the day-to-day things that they do every day, it actually helps us achieve our larger, bigger, you know, hairy, audacious goal. And when we forget to do that, people start to feel the sense of like what they do every day doesn't matter. And that leads to burnout. It leads to bore out. It leads to hopelessness. And it's a simple fix if we just build in these tiny celebrations every day.
You're listening to This Working Life on ABC Radio National with me, Lisa Leong. My guest is Jen Moss, workplace culture expert and author of Why Are We Here? Creating a Work Culture Everyone Wants. Jen, some people might roll their eyes when we start talking about purpose. So I want you to convince us, why do we need to care about purpose? And what's the relationship between a sense of purpose and job satisfaction?
You make a great point. And people do kind of roll their eyes about purpose because it feels like, you know, it's something that you see taped on the side of a wall and it, you know, and it's like, here are my values. Oh, we want to live out our purpose. And it's kind of like a generic thing. And no one actually knows what it means either. Like, what does it mean? And also, you know, why do I have to feel purpose at work? When we look at life satisfaction, when we look again, like if we just sort of, you know, zoom out and think of what really makes us live a happy life, that is a sense of accomplishment. It's Martin Seligman's PERMA. It's like, you know, positive experiences every day. It's engagement in life. It's relationships. It's meaning. It's accomplishment. You know, all of that is really a big part of our overall life satisfaction. So when we spend this much time at work and we bifurcate that need for purpose and meaning, it actually takes away so much from our potential, you know, experience of life overall. And work can be fuel. You know, work can be amazing. And when you do enjoy your job, then it makes it, you know, so much less tedious and mundane and boring. The thing is we think that purpose has to be attached to these big, huge goals. And really, it's not. It's when I talked to the Uber drivers, their purpose was just having conversations with people that might be lonely or, you know, people that were traveling all the time, and they would create friendships with these people in the small amount of time that they had together. Their purpose was bringing, you know, community together or being a good father, and that might mean getting a paycheck that could pay for their children to go to a better school. I mean, it needs to be really about Purpose that really is about our values, our terminal goals, like the things that really matter to us, and attaching to the tasks we do at work every day to that meaning. And it's not what I think employers get wrong is that they make it about a big mission statement. Like, it's all of us want to connect the world to new technology. Like, most people don't care about that every day. That's not what they care about when they're doing whatever, you know, mundane tasks that they have to do, like all of us do, even if we love our jobs, right?
Do you have an easy way to get to our own purpose then that you find helpful?
Absolutely. I love this little hack that I suggest. And this is how leaders and ourselves, we can get to this, like understanding. It's one meeting a week. And I know we're meeting fatigued. So I do say, you know, include this one in where we go around and we ask each other what lights you up, what stresses you out, and what can we do for each other to make next week easier? So you have these quick wins in that effort. So you're building hope, which I love. You're also learning about yourself and you're learning about others, about what motivates us. What are we connected to? What matters? People will say things, you know, about something they're proud of or things that they care about. And so you start to see, okay, as a leader, I can motivate that person based on those values that they love and they cherish. And then what stresses you out is a great prevention tool for managers to avoid burnout, to hear every single week if that person is dealing with not sleeping well and they're feeling stress, well, we can intervene. So we also give people that sense of being able to be healthy, have their time back, to get closer to those values that matter, and then be able to help each other to also achieve those goals every single week.
Jen Moss, when you look at research, it is really quite clear that out of everything that we want to do to live the best life we can, social connection is number one. And it is also really important at work. So do you want to describe how social connection can really help avoid this sense of ennui at work?
I feel like going to work right now is like going to school without art, gym, or recess. It's like no fun. The fun has left the building. We are not doing things that make us feel happy. We're not kibitzing by the water cooler. We're not, you know, we've lost that sense of ritual, which was a big part of work. And it used to be considered forced fun. You'd roll your eyes. You were brought into the kitchen to celebrate someone's birthday with a really horrible slab cake. But what would happen is like you talk to your coworker about something, it created this serendipitous moment, and then you ended up kind of standing by each other's desk to talk about life stuff, and you would laugh more. Right now, when it comes to the community part of it, we've changed what we even see as, you know, as like the thing that we're attracted to in our friendships right now, which I thought was really fascinating research, is that we're looking for people that are accountable and conscientious versus before the pandemic when we were in the office and we had a different kind of way of thinking about working together. It was about agreeableness. It was about shared interest. It was, you could be friends with marketing. And now it's like, if you're in a team, you're only connected to your team and it's all about work. And when I think about wanting to go out on a Friday night and have a, you know, a cool night with a friend or take that friendship kind of beyond, I don't want the conscientious, accountable person. I want, you know, someone that I have shared interests with. And so I think that that is what we need to rebuild. We need to massage that muscle of relational energy and build rituals back and bring friendships as a strategic priority back. And that means we have to intentionally work at that.
Jen, we've done a recent episode about friendships at work, but you have these concepts, simplex versus multiplex. And I think it's really helpful. Can you go through this?
Yes. And I think this is really, what I think is most interesting is that it's kind of like how work has shifted. We've gone from a transactional contract with work to now an expected social contract with work. And the same thing with these simplex versus, you know, these kind of multiplex relationships, right? And the multiplex relationship, so let's start with the simplex relationships. They're just basic transactional, like, Lisa, I need to get this you know, paper from you, or can you share this document with me? It's not that I dislike you or like you, it's just it's a neutral relationship. And more of those simplex relationships are happening because we aren't getting to know each other in a deeper way. And a multiplex relationship is that one where I know you, you know, love to horseback ride and you're married and, you know, and you just had a child a year ago and, you know, you're dealing with, you know, teething or whatever those things, you know, those things are. And when I say, hey, can I get that document? And thanks so much. And I know, you know, you're probably exhausted going through all this stuff. Like you just have different empathy. You have different shorthand. You're more kinder to other people. You care about them more and you care about the overall kind of the overall tenor at work changes when you have more multiplex relationships. And it really is just an empathy exercise, just asking people, hey, like learn more about that person that you're talking to and asking them for that transactional thing. Change that simplex relationship into a multiplex relationship by asking them about who they are.
Jen, even though you said, look, we might be having a group midlife crisis here, you did also say that there were things that we can do at an individual level to make our lives feel that much better this year. So can you go through finally some of your tips for things that we might try in order to get to a better place?
I think what's really important for us is to first give ourselves grace for those emotions. It's okay. We're feeling that way. It makes sense. Just a little bit of grace. And then I like to do this thing on my birthday, but it's also good to do in the first start of the year, is really look at what matters to your overall plan for your life. You know, what are the values? What do you care about? And then align what you want to achieve in your work and your life goals as the same goal, that it isn't this bifurcation between work and life. And it's really like, what is a life well-lived? And put those together and say, I'm going to cut out the other stuff that I know is not necessarily leading to these priorities, because we are tired. We are exhausted. We have a big cognitive load. We can't take on as much. So start to look as rest as productive rest. Start to look at that as, you know, giving yourself the freedom to explore not doing anything for periods of time, and then looking at how you can align your work goals with your life and values. And once you come up with that list, it's amazing, because usually it's a long list and then you have to cull it down to 5 things, because, right, we can achieve 5 things. We can't achieve a million things, and really narrow it down and have some time journaling over a couple of weeks, just exactly what matters to you. And at the end, when you come down to that 5 very concrete goals, it gives us that sense of weight that's been removed, because we don't feel like we have to overspend on the other stuff. And I really feel like that's what's been happening right now. And I see people pushing back and rebelling a bit on this idea that we have to always be on. And I think that that's a good thing. It's changing the dynamic of work, and it's changing how leaders are having to motivate and engage us. But the more we realize that this is just work and it's not our identity. And I think that that's where we need to get to, is that we can have both and not either or.
And Jen, just one more thing for me. Can you repeat that question that you ask yourself before you say yes to anything?
I ask, is this my deathbed regret? Yeah, I ask myself, will I care about whether I sent this email out on my deathbed, or will I care that I didn't have dinner with my family? And sometimes just, you know, breaking it down to that's a winning, you know, strategy for life, I think.
Thanks so much, Jen.
Thanks, Lisa. Thank you.
Jennifer Moss is a journalist, workplace culture expert, and the author of Why Are We Here? Creating a Work Culture Everyone Wants. Thanks for listening to This Working Life with me, Lisa Leong. It was produced by Michelle Weeks and mixed by Carrie Dell on the lands of the Wurundjeri people in Naarm, Melbourne. Until next time, work it, baby.
been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.
Hey, I'm Sana Qadar, and I host All in the Mind on ABC Radio National. It's a show where we investigate why people behave the way they do. But there's some perspectives we don't often hear about, like what makes people cross the line into criminal behaviour?
Abuse, neglect, bullying, adverse childhood backgrounds.
You can't imagine doing that yourself. You can't imagine somebody doing that to you.
Join me for Criminal Psychology, a special series diving into some of these questions. Hear it now on the ABC Listen app.